Hey friends, did you know that Feminist Frequency recently launched the Games and Online Harassment Hotline? Well, we sure did. It is a confidential, text-based emotional support resource for folks who make and play games. You can learn more at gameshotline.org, and please, please help us spread the word so we can reach the people who need it the most.
I know that I watched some things that were this an in-person festival I might not have made time for because, you know, I would think like, oh, this doesn't really sound like something I'd be interested in, or, you know, yeah, it's across town or whatever. But because I was able to just like call everything up, you know, we just got the inclusive pass. You could watch every movie. It was like, well, yeah, I'll just watch this too, and found some really awesome stuff.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I am your second favorite host, Anita Sarkeesian, because there was overwhelming joy for Carolyn as host, which I promise you will come back. But in the meantime, I have my two fabulous co-hosts, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And Ebony Adams.
What's up?
I mean, I also feel like the crowds are brimming and humming for Ebony to give the hosting a go. So we'll see. We'll see about that soon.
No, we're not. We won't.
This week, we're going to be talking about some films featured in the 14th annual LA Skins Fest, a festival of films by and about Indigenous people from throughout North America. Stay tuned. Hello, friends.
Hey.
Yo, can I just say, we got so many messages about Carolyn hosting and how great
she's
she was.
She's got a
so
great
good. I need to
presenter
just
voice.
Hang up my hat, but also for the like ridiculous crying thing that you did on the last episode, which was delightful as well.
I had
do
a lot of
know
fun.
How many people like us who were like, wait,
I know.
Is she? Because it was too good. It was too believable. You had me going. And I mean, like, I think it's a joke.
It's not the first time Carolyn has cried sincerely on the podcast and without any judgment at all.
Yeah,
I think that's completely fine. But I was kind of like, oh, like this is right on cue. Like, what is going on? How
I
long have you been holding
hoped,
this feeling in?
I would have hoped that can you put some sad music here, Rob?
Right.
Thing would have been like a cue that. Probably not like totally serious, but
that's what I thought at first. But then as you got into it, I was like, oh wait, maybe she was planning to do a joke, but then she actually got
wow.
Stop being so good at your podcasting job, Carol. Yeah. Like, just be a little bit worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the point. You nailed it, Ebony. God, what would we do without your insightful
this
observation?
This is why I know, right? This is why people don't like me to babysit their kids, because this is the kind of life advice I give people. Just be a little bit worse.
And also because you're just like, yeah, go ahead, play with the stove. It's cool. Learn how to cook. It's fine.
Listen, you know, we all have to learn hard lessons.
Wow.
All right. Cool. Well, I'm actually excited about this episode. This year, the 14th annual LA Skins Fest took place online from November 18th to 22nd. It's billed as the premier Native American film festival, and this year's offerings ran the gamut from low-budget shorts to feature-length films. They included documentaries, dramas about contemporary family life, films that employed elements of sci-fi and horror to explore generational trauma, and much more. It was an exciting opportunity to see films by and about people whose stories too rarely get told in mainstream media. And while there were far too many films on offer for us to watch them all, we did want to talk a little bit about some of the films that made the strongest impressions on us. I know that we want to, you know, when we're picking out what episodes we want to talk about on FFR, we, you know, like we kind of want to hit some of the mainstream ones and whatever, but like, I think that we all have a feeling of wanting to get a little more, like, you know, explore creators that don't get as much attention and stories that are not often told. And so I really appreciated Ebony's suggestion that we do this week, especially because it's Thanksgiving week.
Yeah.
And all of the historical trauma and historical rewriting that comes with this moment in time. And so we felt like this, the timing of the festival and the stories that it was telling was really important for us for this moment.
Yeah, I mean, so I've lived in LA for 13, 14 years now, excuse me, and have never actually gone to the LA Skins Fest. It's one of those things that comes up on the calendar, you know it's coming, and then inevitably, you know, like I would get busy, and so I wouldn't
whatever,
go.
You just don't want to get off your couch.
That is also true. but no, I mean, I will do it for film, and I know, you know, our listeners presumably are you know, as interested in the screen industries as I am, although they wouldn't be listening to this podcast. But it's one of those things where, like, the opportunity to watch some of these films via a virtual platform was a godsend. And as much as I want, like, you know, us to be free and safe to go out back in the world, I'm excited for the ways that film festivals have really pivoted to increase accessibility for folks by offering these films online, because I just got to sit and watch so many shorts, which I love. I love shorts. And it's only something that I've learned in the past, maybe, I don't know, 5 years or so, how much I love shorts, like as a thing to itself, not, you know, like, oh, this is something I watch because I don't have time to watch a feature or whatever. But like, as a thing itself, I really love. And so this was absolutely fantastic. And if you know anything about the film industry, you know that film festivals are often where careers get made. You know, someone sells something at Sundance and it gets distribution. And then this, you know, that person goes on to have a career because, you know, they get tapped to direct or write other things. And so
although,
film festivals are incredibly important.
I do want to interject that statistically, I believe, sorry, I'm saying this from anecdotal stories, but I think that it's whatever. I've heard from a lot of female directors that they get these great opportunities from Sundance and they get their film sold and distributed. Mm-hmm. And then that doesn't mean anything for them going down the road like it does for a lot of male creators, right? That you think that this is like the start of a great career and then they're struggling just as much as they always have. Not to not to dismiss what you're saying, because it is true, but I also just like was remembering that fact that I've heard about how difficult it still can be for female creators, even once they get like sort of quote unquote discovered for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I do want to be clear that like just having your film in a film festival, that's like the first step, you know, and then generating buzz and then, yeah, getting that ever elusive distribution. You know, these are the sorts of things like you hear, oh, so-and-so is playing at the Sundance Film Festival and then you never hear about the movie again. Well, it's often because it didn't get distribution. So there's nowhere for you to stream it. There's no film that will show it, et cetera. But that is the way that it is supposed to work, you know, that you if you are interested in, you know, becoming a filmmaker, that one of the routes to get there is to by getting your material projects into film festivals. That's a long intro into saying that I was so glad that, you know, we all did this because, yeah, I got to watch a bunch of shorts and, you know, learn about just an incredible amount of filmmakers, some of whom I think like, yo, you absolutely need to be doing more work, because given like more time, more resources, you know, the ability to really stretch yourself in an episodic TV format or in a feature length format, you can really do something.
Yeah. So like you're saying, one of the benefits is that film festivals can give a creator exposure, but there's also so many film festivals like this that are identity specific or topically specific that allow space for creators to showcase their work in places that wouldn't, you know, historically wouldn't have access to. And so I think that that's really valuable. Although like there are so many film festivals that it can be hard to parse through it, but I still think that there's a lot of value there. And, you know, especially this year, it all went digital, right? And so I, as someone like, I like film, but I tend to get very overwhelmed with film festival guides and like running around the city trying to get into screenings and when they are and tickets and all that shit. Like I was so excited to just like sit at home and press play and just like be able to take in like five shorts in a row at my leisure, like throughout the day. I really hope that the digital, like I hope that we get to have both, like when we can, if we ever can actually be in person again in movie theaters. Like I hope that we can also have the opportunity for digital accessibility at home.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that I watched some things that were this an in-person festival, I might not have made time for because, you know, I would think like, oh, this doesn't really sound like something I'd be interested in, or, you know, yeah, it's across town or whatever. But because I was able to just like call everything up, you know, we just got the inclusive pass. You could watch every movie. It was like, well, yeah, I'll just watch this too, and found some really awesome stuff. That's the other wonderful thing about film festivals is that you can see people doing really new, ambitious things. Some of them work, some of them don't, you know, but there, you really do have the opportunity to see things that typically don't make it onto the big screen. I'm thinking about specifically the short Tatsu Red Bird, which is sort of like an overlapping back and forth short about two indigenous women, one in the past, one in, you know, some unspecified, like kind of dystopian future. And I just was watching it and was just like, fuck yeah, like more of this, please. Like, y'all know science fiction is my jam. So the minute, you know, someone dressed up in like rollerball gear shows up, I'm in it to win it, you know. But I was like, yes, like how many stories from, you know, non-white peoples are we not getting, you know? Science fiction, like film science fiction is still, like everything, overwhelmingly white and male. This was an indigenous woman. And I was just like, yes, give me more. I want to know. I would watch absolutely a feature film about this right now.
Yeah. Tatsu, you know, I'm glad you brought up Tatsu because, you know, when you mention like shorts as a film, you know, medium unto themselves, right? Like Tatsu is one of the films that springs to mind as an example of a film that works so well. It's like 10 minutes long. And like it is, you know, it is like laser focused on the thing that it's doing, which is this sort of, you know, time hopping experience where an indigenous woman in the past is being pursued by like a white, you know, killer or, you know, certainly a man who's
like
who's
a colonialist.
Colonialist, exactly. And then, in the, you know, an indigenous woman in the future. Who does look kind of like something out of like a Road Warrior movie or whatever. Mm-hmm. She's got like her futuristic garb. She's got like a, you know, a badass kind of red face paint, you know, and, you know, it, like is being chased by, you know, what looks like some sort of, yeah, like sci-fi bounty hunter figure or something
like that.
He looks
like the Terminator.
Yeah, oh, yeah, but more.
I thought he looked more like RoboCop, like
more like RoboCop. Sure, yeah, sure. That's much better. Yeah, more like RoboCop with the helmet off, like so. Yeah. But there's something like, you know, he's like like a weird, eerie mix of human and machine, right? And like the way it's hopping back and forth through time, you know, it suggests like there's deep meaning in that. It suggests like patterns that repeat throughout history, but it also is just like visually and cinematically thrilling to watch, and it you know the it makes that ending, you know, it doesn't have like what we would consider like a traditional kind of resolution or anything like that, but as a short, you know, it just delivers this jolt, like it's just and it works. So it's simultaneously a film that I think really benefits from being a short and uses the format of the short to its strength by just knowing like exactly how to trim all the, you know, all the excess out of the narrative and just like deliver the concept in a way that's visually exciting and narratively exciting. But while also being like totally a film where, you know, the filmmakers or whatever, like I would be like, oh, hey, somebody please give them a ton of money to like make that into a like a feature film and like because I want to know more about this. What is the world like? What is the narrative like? Why is this future bounty hunter chasing this woman? What is the connection? Like, is there some, you know, more significant connection between the woman in the past and the woman in the future? Like, you know, like there's just so much that could be done with that. So it simultaneously like works super well as what it is. And seems to me to vibrate with so much potential for what it could be if it were like expanded upon.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I'm going to say something, but I'm not going to mean it. Like, it's not the most unique story, but it is because it's coming from this perspective and this voice. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, the contrast and the like overarching theme is sort of the terrorization and the destruction of white people against indigenous folks or white men against indigenous women. I don't know how specific that is, but that's what we see here. And I think that there's like something really important about taking the kinds of stories, the kinds of dystopian fears that we have, the ways that we erase or, you know, the ways that we even talk about history that are very complicated and not as accurate as they probably should be, and turning it into a story about like specific indigenous identity. I think that there's so much value to that and so much excitement and interest for me, at least in that kind of story. And I'm totally with you, Carolyn. I was like, give them more money. Let's make this a feature. And not to say that it's not valuable or interesting as a short. When we got to the like end part of the few, I'm assuming that most of our viewers haven't, our listeners haven't seen it. So we should, we are going to spoil things, and we're also going to like explain the whole, each of the films in more detail than we normally do. But at the very end, when the RoboCop dude shows up, I was like, damn, what kind of budget did they have for this? Because like that got way more involved, like costuming and like shit than I was expecting this film to have.
Yeah, and I know we're going to talk about Intrepidus. I had the same reaction in Intrepidus, like, wow, this is really shot beautifully. And some of the effects on this thing are really fucking good. But just staying on Tatsu for a moment, one of the things that I really loved about it is the ways that it encouraged me to ask questions about the world that were not answered in the short itself, but that I wanted to consider, right? And again, this is related to what you were saying, Anita, about just the simple fact of having a young indigenous woman as, you know, the lead characters, you know, makes you ask, like, okay, where are we? When are we? And why don't I typically see these sorts of characters in media like this? We are very accustomed to seeing, you know, white folks in, you know, like dystopian futures, for instance, or worlds in which it's still primarily white folks and, you know, people are speaking English and whatever. And you're like, okay, but where is everybody else? You mean to tell me that like the entire like social, you know, calculus that governs our present day society is still, you know, in place in whatever far future we're talking about here. So I appreciate it that this film, you know, encouraged you to ask like, okay, why is it that the complexion of the future always has looked the way that it has been? And there's a short scene, you know, where we get the, presumably the mother and father of the young girl in the past talking about her. And then the mother and father of the girl from the future talking about her, you know, like, oh, she wants to run, you know, she's different, whatever. And I wasn't sure, but the father of the future, to me, looks like he might be a white dude, but was speaking, you know, this native language, right? And I was like, yes, okay, so just the suggestion that perhaps there has been an upending in our expectations, you know? For what the future will be, that English will not always be on top, that whiteness will not always be on top. I just found it really fascinating. And again, like, science fiction is my jam, so I will take it in any format that I can get it, which probably, you know, I was really glad to watch the shorts that I did. I watched a lot of the ones in the number one programming block because I was like, okay, I want to see how a curator put these together. Like, why these films in this block? And so, you know, it was interesting, like watching these different shorts play off against each other.
Yeah. One narrative thing, you were talking about the parents being like, oh, she's so, you know, rebellious.
Mm-hmm. She's difficult, I think is something.
She's difficult. Yeah. Thank you. There, I like, so because of shorts, like you have to convey a lot of information or you have to do things subtly and hope the audience gets it because you have such limited space and time. So I'm like, I really hope that she actually destroys those white dudes because I don't want the like difficult woman to like be punished for being difficult, right?
Yeah.
So, but the story obviously I think smartly doesn't show you the point of it is not to show her persevere. The point is about like the violence and the predatory nature of
this theme both of women being targets of violence and of women fighting back against violence is something that recurred in actually a number of films throughout the festival, you know, including a documentary called Blackfeet Boxing, which, you know, first of all, like, I mean, was staggering for me in the sense that it details, it includes some truly like devastating statistics about the epidemic of violence against, you know, like Native women, Indigenous women, mm-hmm. that occurs in, I guess, on reservations and, you know, throughout the United States and maybe throughout North America. But, you know, this documentary is about specifically about like a boxing gym where girls and young women are like taught to box and to fight and to defend themselves, like specifically largely as a response or as a way of defending themselves, you know, out of necessity, because the likelihood of any of them being, you know, targeted, attacked, at some point in their, you know, in is so high. And like, for me, there's a really powerful image from this film where one of the promising young female boxers that the film focuses on, like writes, in red ink, like, or has written on, you know, in red ink on like her, the bandages that a boxer, I guess, wraps around their hands before, you know, putting in the gloves on and before fight, like writes MMIW, which stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, which, you know, is, I guess, like, there's just a lots of calls to raise awareness. And I mean, there's marches and all these things, but it's not, but it's something that I was largely like unaware of before watching this film, which kind of was, again, just feels like, like, what, you know, this is horrifying, and why don't we all know about this? Like, that this epidemic, right, of violence is happening.
Because, yeah, this country doesn't care about women of color.
Right.
That's why. Yeah. I did notice that there was one sign during one of the marches that said MMIP, which I'm going to guess is Murdered and Missing Indigenous People. I'm wondering, yeah, if there is a... Because it's happening primarily to women, but I'm wondering if there, yeah, is a gender inclusive, well, like,
there were
that was, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely a few signs, like, so there were people with signs with names on them, and some of those, mm-hmm, names, at least, you know, at least a few of them were names that, you know, I believe were names of men as well. So, so yes, I think there are also, of course, men who this epidemic is experienced, you
or
know,
I'm thinking more like non-binary folks than,
oh, okay,
that right, was my assumption, but I could be totally wrong there. But yes, like, that documentary I thought was, you know, I was really powerful in a lot of ways, and one of the things that kept like coming up for me, so the context of the documentary is that there are a couple of people that are being followed in this. One is the family of a woman named Ashley. I'm sorry, I didn't write her name down. But it's a woman that has gone missing, and it's been 2 years, and the family is still like doing their own investigative work, right? They're literally like going out into the wilds and looking for bones, to see if, you know, they suspect that she's probably been murdered, and they're still trying to find out what's happened to her, because the law enforcement in the area is so deeply underfunded, mm-hmm, on that particular reservation. And as the documentary goes to point out, like, this is not unique to them. And so then we enter into the boxing club, as Carolyn said, where this man, Frank Kipp, who had previously been a trained fighter, had seen what is happening to these women in his community and wanted to empower them to fight back. So, like, there's a bit of tension here, because the whole, like, self-defense, like, courses and like the self-defense component of like fighting against violence against women is rightfully critiqued in the feminist world around, like, it's not our fault. Like, we shouldn't have to defend ourselves. Right. We should not be perpetrated against. But at the same time, there is something really powerful about watching these young women, like, have literal power, right? Like, yeah, there is something empowering about feeling strong and feeling like you can defend yourself. So, you know, there's some conflict there of like, this isn't the answer, but like nothing else is happening right now. And so therefore this is what they have. And like, who cares whether I support it or not, but I do, right? Like, I think that it's really important to this community. And it is, I'm going on and on about this, no. But the other component of this is that these communities have a lot, as they showed in the documentary, like these young women end up doing a lot of drugs. They can end up, yes, like being coming from families that are not really supportive of them or even around for them. And so like it feels like this boxing club has become like a family for a lot of these folks, and boxing as a way out of such a sort of destitute isolated existence in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm thinking about the breadth of the offerings and the LA Skins Fest and how we're able to see stories like this one, you know, at the same time that there is space for, you know, joy and silliness and kids movies. Like, this is what we need more of. You know, we need to make space for more of these important stories. But what I loved about this film, and the films like it and the festival, is the way that it just gives you such a like three-dimensional understanding of, I don't know, I'm not articulating this well, but just particularly in this country, you know, because this is the country I know, Indigenous folks have been rendered largely invisible. And that is what has made it so easy for people to prey upon them from within and from without, you know, including like, you know, the huge numbers of, you know, murdered and missing folks. And it is not until we, you know, sort of open our eyes to the ways in which like whole peoples have been denied that anything can be done. Sorry, I was thinking that as you were talking about it, you know, this like the tension between, you know, wanting to equip these girls, these women with, you know, like physical prowess to defend themselves, but it's all about so much more than just whether, you know, can you punch and, you know, can you knock someone out? That it is about like reclaiming, you know, space in the world, yeah, and asserting that.
When I was watching this too, it reminded me of the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, which was a movement, mm-hmm, in the 70s and 80s about, these mothers would march and be activists in this space where their children were being disappeared, mm-hmm, by the military dictatorship, which is a different context, right? In Blackfeet Boxing, they talk about, there's one line in passing about how, because they don't talk about who's perpetuating the harm. And there is a line, mm-hmm, in passing about how like perpetrators will come to the reservations because they know they can get away with it. So right, like there isn't really, they don't, yeah, make it super clear whether it is like folks of the reservation causing the harm or outsiders. But that one line in passing was like, you know, there's so little resources on a lot of these reservations that people are like, great, breeding, like this is an easy ground to like take, you know, to be horrific humans. And mm-hmm, so I kind of bring up the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo because one, like it reminded me so much of this, of like the idea of people being disappeared is not unique. Yeah. It is not, mm-hmm, new. It is something that has existed in many places around the world at various times under various governments. And it's absolutely fucking horrifying. And it sort of reminded me, that connection reminded me of another documentary that we watched called Walking Together, which, mm-hmm, like, you know, I didn't really love this one.
Yeah.
But like, I wasn't even sure if we should talk about it. But like this connection, like, I wonder if, you know, if these people, if like folks from reservations where people have gone missing, and like these mothers or, you know, the community of people who have been disappeared, like could find connection, right, and communion in some sort with each other. And Walking Together is about Indigenous youth from Canada going to a couple of places in Africa and talking to Indigenous folks from that region and sharing connection and history and all of that, which, like, theoretically sounds cool. Like, the people who, like, work at the organization, the ones that they interviewed, at least, most of them were white.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah. Don't like this.
No, mm-hmm. I feel a little churlish, I guess, is maybe a word, like, if for saying anything critical about any of these films, because, like, I fully support, you know, like, the existence of these films and, you know, everything. But, you know, at the same time, like, I consider it, like, it's a show of respect to talk about a film, you know, and engage with it as I would, you know, if it were like an act, like a commercially released film or whatever. So, you know, I guess my, like, one of the issues I had with Walking Together. So it is like it's super cool to me, like, this idea of, you know, Indigenous youth from Canada going to, you know, to say, I think they go, some of them go to, like, Uganda, you know, and mm-hmm. and elsewhere, you know, in Africa, like, and one of the connecting tissues there in the film, you know, at least mentions this in passing, is like the harm done to our communities and our peoples by colonialism. But the film, like, it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really, like, talk about that much, you know. It's really more about, like, you know, and it's fine that this is what it is, but I wish it were something else. It's really like, hey, here's, like, the kind of fun experiences and, like, that these kids, you know, these young people had.
It feels like a promotional video for the nonprofit that did this work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wondered a bit, and if it wasn't sort of, you know, replicating, if it wasn't a little condescending itself to some of the people in Africa, like, I did sort of feel like, I don't know. It does a thing, for instance, where it all, like, a lot of the people, you know, the black people who we are interviewed are subtitled, and but, you know, like, speaking English, and others people are not subtitled, and
interesting,
you know, and I'm, and I don't know, I'm sort of like, do you have to do that? Like, I can understand them, okay. But I don't know, like, I do understand, though. They obviously they have a particular accent that some viewers, like, may not understand them as clearly, you know, but there's, like, these shots of a poor, you know, villagers in Africa getting, like, seeds that will help sustain their garden and everything. And I don't know. I just feel like there's almost a way in which, like, through the lens of the film, the Indigenous youth from Canada, like, I'd rather the stories of these people in Africa be told in a way that focuses on them, because in the dynamic of this film, the youth from Canada, the Indigenous youth from Canada, are, like, are privileged in a significant degree. Yeah, I mean,
it feels like the way that it's framed is that Westerners are going to see how, like, rugged it is in Africa.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not the point of this internship and this event and this organization. Like, the point, like Carolyn was saying, was about, like, shared commonality around colonialism.
Yeah.
Different aspects, but it just, they didn't really talk about that.
Yeah. So I want to be clear. Like, I think it's super, super cool that this exists, like, that these Indigenous Canadian youth are doing this, and that these connections are being made about, like, hey, our communities have been, like, ravaged and you know, and harmed historically by colonialism. Like, let's talk about that and everything. Like, and, you know, and that to me is, like, the main thing I took away from Walking Together. So like, that in and of itself is super cool. Like, even if I don't agree with the way it was framed in this documentary, or it wasn't the most interesting look at this that it could have been, like, it's just super cool that exists.
So where did you say they went? So I didn't watch this one. So they went to Uganda, you said?
I don't remember all of the places they went. There were several. They made several stops.
Yeah. And it was like the group like split up, and some of them went one place, some of them went someplace else. I'm sorry, I don't remember.
No, I mean, but I think that's interesting, right? Like, the fact that you can't call it to mind. I have a real problem with, you know, and again, I haven't seen it, so I don't know that this, you know, critique is accurate, but, you know, it sounds as if it replicates, you know, a really harmful trope in that Africa is seen as like this totality, you know, not the huge continent that it is.
They don't do that. The film doesn't do that as much. It doesn't do that, right? Like they actually are like this, and I think Carolyn and I are just forgetting. Like they make it clear where they are. Yeah. We're just being like, it wasn't North or South Africa. It was like Central, West, East. I don't fucking remember. I'm sorry, I always feel terrible not being specific about that. But they do talk about, so some of the ways that the individuals talk about the places aren't good. Like some of them were like, it's really dusty here, and you're like, okay, can you maybe some more. They do talk about the environments that are different, the cultures that are different in the different places that they go. And then they get specifically into the different, like the nonprofits that they volunteer at are wildly different in terms of their goals.
This is what I want. So was this a short as well, or was this a feature length?
It's like 20 minutes.
Yeah. So I think, you know, with something like this, you can get a taste, but yeah, like I'm going to want much more about the specific places they go to. In Africa, right? So if they're going to Ghana, or if they're going to Nigeria, or, you know, Uganda or whatever, because, you know, you can't just, and I'm not saying again that the film does this, but I'm saying like you want any project to spend some time exploring like the different, you know, effects of colonialism on the like cultural production and identity creation of different indigenous groups, you know, as that obtains in different places, right? So like, you know, things are going to look different depending upon where you go and depending upon who is going, you know, like where the indigenous youth themselves are from in Canada and, you know, like what tribes they're enrolled in. So like, I think that's interesting. But then also like, you know, there's so, oh boy, you really have to know what you're doing when it comes to like these kinds of trips that you make to, you know, different regions, that you aren't simply displacing the othering that you put on a home population onto an external population.
Yeah, totally. There are two other shorts that we watched that I think I want to get to before we wrap up because we're kind of running out of time.
Yeah.
Let's talk about The Fall first, because that one was a little bit shorter. And I want to give us some space for the next one. So The Fall was a short film about a father struggling to maintain life with his two daughters amidst the unknown return of their mother. The description says drug addicted mother, but that isn't made clear in the actual film itself, as far as I remember.
Well, my experience of the film is that the way that at the end of the short, you have two daughters who, you know, and their dad, and their dad is like struggling. I thought this was like really well done. I really liked this.
I did too.
I thought the acting was just excellent. I thought the way that it showed the father's like struggle, you know, I mean, it was like a really interesting way of acknowledging like drug addiction is obviously not like, or whatever, absent parents are not unique to indigenous populations, but they happen in a very specific and particular way and are, you know, are particularly like widespread and so on and so forth. You know, I think where I picked up on it was at the very end. So the daughters, the two adorable daughters, like one of them, because the dad won't tell them a story that night because he's just like psychologically and emotionally just like exhausted. One of them tells a story to the other in a way that I think there's something about like the language that she uses in the story that hints at like the mother's drug addiction.
So really quickly to recap too, is that like you see these adorable little girls.
Oh,
like they were such
cute.
A treat. I was like, how did they direct them? Did they just say like play and then hope that like worked for the film? Because they were delightful. But you see the father with these two girls, like telling them a story. You see him playing with them. You see him having to like make them dinner and like give them a bath. You see him having to go out when his brother comes and, or the uncle of the kids come and watch them. Like, it's just like these moments of this.
It's like a Carol movie in short form, in the sense that it's very much about like, it's just a very observational
like
film
life,
about domestic life, you know?
Yeah. And there's a scene where the girls are playing with makeup. And I thought it was really interesting that they didn't put the makeup on. Like, I was like, that I didn't understand. Like, if you were a kid, you absolutely would put it on. Like, that was weird to me. Mm. And then it becomes super clear, like, what an impactful ending where the father is just like, he's fucking had it and he's tired. Mm-hmm. And he sees, like, he sees something that acknowledges that the girls were playing with the makeup, and like, that is a thing that you're not allowed to do in this house. And he reprimands them and yells at them. And like, afterwards, there's a scene where he's just so defeated that he like takes all the makeup out and puts it on his face. Like, he puts lipstick on, and then he just like literally smears the makeup all over himself and like and howls. And it's just
it's like, it's almost like he's trying to manifest or conjure her, maybe, you know, like the film doesn't spell out emotionally, like, or psychologically exactly what's happening inside of him, but there is, which makes it all the more like powerful and believable, I think. But what a great scene that is.
I was so impressed by the acting of this short. It is so quiet, and it takes its time, and it doesn't have a lot of time. And yet you are given such a deep sense, you know, of like the love that this father has for his daughters, you know, and what life is like for them. And yes, you know, excuse me, as a single parent, you know that it's tough. And yet there's still these moments of lightness in the film. But Anita, those two girls, this is something I was struck by too. Like, it is, acting is hard, y'all. I think people, you may think that like the camera is just turned on you and you just, you know, repeat the lines that are on the page and, you know, everything is great. That's not how it works. Acting is hard. And you can see, you know, with children and other, you know, media, how hard something like this is for someone to be like completely like authentic in the moment, and particularly young children. You know, I mean, what we're asking them to do in front of a camera is not necessarily natural, but this short, you would assume that, like, you know, these were just home movies.
I was like, are these his kids?
There was no awareness of the camera, like, at all.
Yeah, I was like, are these his kids? Because, and do they already have this relationship? Because this is too good. Like, child actors are the fucking worst. And like, they're young enough that it would be hard to give them direction, you know?
Exactly. And I mean, like, if you have children in your life who you've ever just tried to take a picture of, and you're like, okay, just pose, just smile for me. And you know how hard that is.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that they are able to get these performances out of these young girls, oh my God. And the fact that they didn't wear pants throughout the entire thing. They're just wearing shorts and their underwear. I'm like, this is so perfect. Like, this is, kids don't wear no clothes that they don't have to, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, loved it. I absolutely loved it.
I did too. It was a real treat. I hope it is something that becomes available for folks to see in more wider viewing. And then lastly, Intrepidus.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ebony, do you want to tell us, do you want to give us like the overview for the audience about what the film is?
Yeah. So, excuse me. Intrepidus is the story of this troubled Indigenous foster kid who goes to, it seems like it's a summer camp / day home, or group home rather, kind of situation out in the woods. And the way that he is forced to confront these, like, these terrifying memories and like the external manifestation of these memories, we find during the course of the short, I think it's around like 25 minutes, 30 minutes long, that, you know, he's been in trouble most of his young life. Much of it stemming from the fact that his mother committed suicide in a very violent way.
Yeah. Which, I'm going to cut you off real quick. Mm-hmm. Carolyn was like, hey, Intrepidus is really interesting. It's kind of a horror movie. And I was like, okay, kind of a horror movie. I'm just I'm not going to tell you how, but the way that the mother commits suicide or complete suicide, like, is so horrifically gruesome. I was cursing Carolyn's name for not like preparing me for that.
Like, it is, there are moments of genuine, like, it is creepy, yeah. It is unsettling. There are terrifying moments when we see the image of the mother's body on the floor and she's like, you know, looking into the camera and then smiles. I almost had to go walk around. I was like, okay, woo, you did it. You and did it, creepy, Alex Greenlee.
Sorry, I like, and the creepy monster in the woods, but finish telling the story so the audience knows what we're talking about.
So that's essentially it. And the main character is, you know, has these kind of like tense conversations with the head counselor of this group home, who is also Native himself, but who importantly has shorter hair. And so there's this very like fascinating scene between the two of them, you know, this consultation where, you know, the head counselor, whose name I'm blanking on, is, you know, saying to the kid, like, you know, if you have trouble, you know, like, being open about your Native identity, if this is something you want to hide, why don't you cut your hair? And the
more
kid
like
back
calling
and
him
like,
out on his hypocrisy than like actually suggesting he cut his hair.
Right, exactly. You know, but then the kid turns around and says, like, you know, is that why you cut your hair? Or, you know. So it's very interesting, you know, the way that the short sets it up is like, you know, this trauma, this horror that hasn't been dealt with in this kid's life has to be confronted for it to be put to bed. It's very effective on a lot of levels. And like we mentioned at the, you know, top of the episode, like just because these things are short doesn't mean that these people are making them with like a dog and two coconuts. Like some money and time went into the creation of the shooting of it, the effects. It is very well done.
It is, but not just money. I mean, obviously, like, yes, there was some money spent. So the director of this is Alex Greenlee, but also like just, you know, just skill. And like, I mean, like so Intrepidus, not to take anything away from Alex Greenlee, because no filmmaker creates in a total vacuum. I mean, it's actually good to learn from, you know, from great filmmakers who have preceded you. Like this film to me, and I don't know if this is accurate, but it had a Peter Jackson influence, but it reminded me very much of Peter Jackson's work, particularly like his pre-Lord of the Rings, low budget, like horror work.
Right.
Something about like the lighting, like the use of lighting and camera angles and stuff in this film was very, very effective at conveying, you know, mood and just foreboding and danger. And I mean, those early Peter Jackson films were quite gory too. So like, you know, I would see that influence or that tradition at least be carried on here too. It has a sort of guest appearance by
Michael Horst.
Michael Horst, who played Hawk on Twin Peaks, who I just always love seeing that guy.
To see him.
A fantastic actor and just a wonderful screen presence. Like I don't know, like my one, I guess, issue. So this film starts with the counselor, the camp counselor, telling a story about. I believe it's like a, you know, a tribe of Native Americans where the women were, you know, like raped and murdered by white, you know, obviously white, like colonialists, like settlers. Yeah. And, you know, that's like the quote unquote spooky ghost story that kind of opens the film. And I don't know, like, I guess I some part of me sort of wished that like what the main character was ultimately dealing with, like the manifestation of horror and evil that he confronted in the end was a reflection of like the white, you know, people who have visited so much violence and oppression on like indigenous people.
Yeah.
And like the fact that he like essentially has to like re-kill his own mother. I was like, I mean, and maybe there are good reasons for that, like in a sort of that I'm unaware of. It did to me feel a bit like I don't know, like that's
I think so. Yes, I agree. But I think that the film is about like the physical manifestation of trauma and his trauma of seeing his mother. Well, of his mother not being a good mother to him, and then seeing her having killed herself, like taking the holding the weapon, the knife that she used this whole time. And then that being tied to his, you know, kind of wanting to erase his indigenous identity, because right. at the very end, he says, my mom and I were the last, and, like sort of as yeah. a reclaiming. But I agree. I kind of wanted it to go a different direction. Like I didn't want him to like stab his mother. And when you see the big scary monster up like transform into his mother, you immediately know that he's going to have to kill her to like end this thing. That's been foreshadowed for
yeah.
a lot of it. I just didn't buy that he was ready to do that. Like this movie, that ending or that kind of framing to this movie, I don't think worked as well in a short as it would have in a longer piece where you had more time for the character to really grapple with, like, I need to like end this memory. I need to end this cycle of like torture I'm putting myself through. I don't think that he was ready to do that after one night. Mm. Like I just don't think that he would have. So for me, that is where the film felt short a little bit. Mm.
Yeah, I felt the one area that I wanted more from this was more exploration of Cheeto, the head counselor guy, because, you know, I felt some tension there with him. We see him at the end crying, you know. I wanted to know more about who he was and the way that he interacts with these kids. And the ways that he brings his native identity to his job, and then how he understood what he was confronted with. That's what I wanted more of. And I thought, if there was more time, we would have been able to get that.
This is a great example of like, Tatsu and The Fall are like very good self-contained shorts that do exactly what they need to do in the period of time that they need to do them in. And Intrepidus feels like it was a feature film that like got forced into a short.
You know, interestingly, so Intrepidus was a student film. I happened to see the casting notice on backstage for it. And I'm just thinking like, I love this. Like the idea that, you know, I say kids because I'm 87 years old, but like kids in film school are doing such interesting work like this.
I know.
And that you get a guy like Michael Horse in your student film. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Totally. I do, so good. Too. I'm so glad we did this. All right, we will be right back. You know something you can do today? You can head over to patreon.com/femfreak and become one of our patrons. That's right. If you back this podcast, not only are you helping us keep it on the air and keep feminist critical media criticism alive, but you also get loads of fun perks like early access to podcast episodes, very special bonus episodes, merch discounts. What else you got? We even let our patrons help us decide on new episodes and upcoming topics. So go ahead and check that out. Patreon.com/femfreak. Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. Carolyn, what have you been hanging out with?
Well, I want to talk about a film that I watched. So there is actually an anthology series of films on Amazon Prime, and it is called Small Axe. That's A-X-E, Acts. And it's by Steve McQueen, the filmmaker behind films like 12 Years a Slave and Widows and, you know, and other films. And this is, so it's five films that are not connected, like, directly by character or plot, but they are unified by all being about the experiences of Black people from the West Indies living in Britain and I think they range in time period from like the late 1960s to the early 1980s. And there's like a new film appearing every Friday. And so the first film is currently out and it is called Mangrove. And it is about an incident, you know, in British history that I was previously completely unaware of. It is a film. There was a man opened a restaurant called Mangrove, which was a community like hub, you know, meeting place for you know, a lot of Black people in Notting Hill. You know, a lot of there was a lot of political activity happening there, a lot of, you know, organizing and, you know, things of that nature. And the, you know, racist police force raided it constantly. And eventually there was a march, or sort of protest march, by the owners and, you know, patrons of the restaurant and the police. They had an encounter with the police. Of course, the police were tried to violently squash the march, and the marchers were then put on trial. You know, and it was, I mean, obviously the whole thing was sort of just an exercise in state power, trying to, you know, assert dominance and crush any sort of, like, you know, movement toward empowerment or self-actualization by these people. And the only cast member I recognize is Letitia Wright, who plays a Black Panther, like, labor organizer, who's one of the marchers who's put on trial. And, like, about this, it's the, you know, the second half of the film is essentially like a courtroom drama about the trial. And it's just really, really well done. It's so well acted. It's such a fascinating, story about a historical incident, again, that I was unaware of. And the second film, which isn't up yet, but I guess will be up this Friday, is called Lover's Rock. And I don't know much about that one, but I do know that like, film festival Twitter that I follow was absolutely raving about it when it was playing at film festivals earlier this year. So I'm super looking forward to that one. So, yeah, if you have Amazon Prime, even though Amazon fucking sucks and is evil, and I feel weird talking about, like, social justice-y, you know, right, narratives and stuff when they're on Amazon, because fuck Jeff Bezos.
Hard when it's like we're so entrenched with Amazon everywhere.
Oh, but I highly recommend checking out Small Axe and the first entry, Mangrove.
Sweet.
I cannot wait.
Yeah. I haven't even heard of this, so I'm really excited to check it out.
Yeah.
All right, y'all. Thank you so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Stay tuned for the freaking after party, which is only available to backers of this podcast. You can learn more at patreon.com/femfreak. The show is engineered by Rob Pera. Carrie Stimson provides technical support, artwork by Jamie Varon, and our intro music is by Phil Circus. Bye.
Bye.
Later.